Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Gary Crist on the show. Gary has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Esquire, the Wall Street Journal, and elsewhere. He's the best-selling author of the acclaimed narrative nonfiction books, The Mirage Factory, Empire of Sin, City of Scoundrels, and The White Cascade. He has also written five works of fiction. Crist has received the Stephen Crane Award, the Sue Kaufman Prize from the Academy of Arts and Letters, a Public Scholar Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities, a Lowell Thomas Gold Medal for Travel Journalism, amongst other awards. The subject of today's episode is Gary's new book, Trespassers at the Golden Gate, a true account of love, murder, and madness in Gilded Age San Francisco. Here's a description of the book. Shortly before dusk on November 3rd, 1870, just as the ferryboat El Capitan was pulling away from its slip into the San Francisco Bay, a woman, clad in black, emerged from the shadows and strode across the crowded deck. Reaching under her veil, she drew a small pistol and aimed it directly at a well-dressed man sitting quietly with his wife and children. The woman fired a single bullet into his chest. "I did it, and I don't deny it," she said, when arrested shortly after. "He ruined both myself and my daughter." Though little remembered today, the trial of Laura D. Fair for the murder of her lover, A.P. Crittenden, made headlines nationwide. As best-selling author Gary Crist reveals, the operatic facts of the case, a woman strung along for years by a two-timing man, killing him in an alleged fit of madness, challenged an American populace still searching for moral consensus after the Civil War. The trial shone an early and uncomfortable spotlight on social issues like the role of women, the sanctity of the family, and the range of acceptable expressions of gender, while jolting the still adolescent metropolis of 1870 San Francisco, a city eager to shed its rough-and-tumble Gold Rush-era reputation. Trespassers at the Golden Gate brings readers inside the untamed frontier town, a place where, for a brief period, otherwise marginalized communities found unique opportunities. Readers will meet wealthy black housekeeper, an enterprising Chinese brothel madam, and a French rabble-rouser who refused to dress in sufficiently feminine clothing, as well as familiar figures like Mark Twain and Susan B. Anthony, who became swept up in the drama of the Laura Fair affair. This was so much fun to record with Gary. I had such a great time talking about this book and some of his others. I know you'll enjoy this conversation. Let's go meet Gary Crist. Are you a New Jersey writer? What effect does the setting of your upbringing have on your writing?
I grew up in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which is right across the river from New York. And New York was always this sort of shining vision as I was growing up. Sometimes we'd get our courage up and cross the George Washington Bridge and visit the city. So I think I've been fascinated with cities because of that proximity to New York for my entire life. And for the past 15 years, that's what I've been writing about. I've been doing this series of what I call city narratives, which are basically these books that try to tell the larger story of a particular American city. Usually it's some transition period when it goes from being a relative backwater to being a place of real significance. But I try to do that through personal stories of a limited number of individuals. And sometimes they're famous people, sometimes they're semi-famous, sometimes they're not famous at all. So,
I saw that you attended Princeton. Did you manage to take John McPhee's writing course while you were there?
I did not. A lot of my friends did, my wife did, but I did not. In freshman year, I applied for a poetry seminar and did not get in. And I said, oh, to hell with them. I'm not going to take any writing courses. I ended up being a comparative literature major. I took a few history courses, but that was a later development.
What was your biggest takeaway from studying in Germany for your Fulbright?
I think it was just getting a totally different perspective on things. Living abroad, you really start to examine all of your assumptions and realize that the things that you regard as normal are not necessarily normal to most people throughout the world. I'm a great believer in travel because I think it just makes you think in a bigger way.
Absolutely. Let's talk about fiction and nonfiction. Typically, I would say writers have one of the two muscles, but you have both. Why do you think it's uncommon that people have both of those muscles?
I don't know. The kind of nonfiction I write is very novelistic, so that may be one reason. There really is a different kind of anxiety associated with either one of them. On the one hand, when I was writing novels, there was that empty page syndrome where you just sit down and it's like it all has to come out of you. With nonfiction writing, particularly the kind that I do, you're so dependent on the existing historical record, and the anxiety is, will the material be there that will enable me to bring this story to life? And
Yeah.
that's really one criterion that I use that's indispensable, is I have to find out what the documentation is like before I decide on a particular story. So it can be the most compelling and dramatic story in the world, but if it's not well documented, I can't use it, because I'd like to write novelistically. And so I've got to have dialogue. I've got to have scenes of confrontation between characters. I've got to have vivid descriptions, but I can't make it up. I hold myself as a nonfiction writer to fairly strict scholarly standards. So I've got to find all of that in the existing literature.
That kind of leads to my next question. What do you do when you face a gap in the historical record and there's maybe not a source to fill in that crucial part in the plot?
I am a great believer in the writer and the reader trusting each other. And when I don't know, I will tell that to the reader. And I have extensive endnotes in all of my books. And in them, sometimes I will discuss issues of, this is a biography, but it doesn't have any footnotes, and there are certain aspects of it that make me not trust it as much. So I will, if I'm going to quote from that source, I will quote it with a caveat that I'm not entirely sure that this is a reliable source. So it's just trying to be straight with your audience. Let them know when you don't really know for sure.
I think one of the great strengths of your books is setting scenes. Is there a certain way you conceptualize setting scenes or lay it out structurally in your head?
This is where I think I got my start as a fiction writer, and where it really helps me in these narrative nonfiction things, is that I'm thinking about the same things. I've got, excuse me, I've got to have action that brings out the character of the people who are in the room. And there's got to be revealing dialogue. That's always the biggest challenge in these books, is you have to find things like court testimony or memoirs or personal letters or something like that, where you can actually quote people speaking to each other. And it's that doesn't, people lie all the time, even on the stand in court. But then they lie in any other document that a historian has to rely on. So you basically have to make these judgments on how reliable you think any particular piece of information is.
Can you talk about your research process for this book or Mirage Factory or Empire of Sen? What does that look like for you? Are there phases of it? Do you spend a lot of time in archives? Talk to us about your process.
Yeah, people are sometimes surprised that I start with the city before I decide on what particular stories I'm going to weave together in the book, because that's the project I'm on. I'm on this city narrative project. So I started with Chicago, and then I went to New Orleans, then I went to LA, and now I'm in San Francisco. And the first stage is just reading voraciously in the secondary literature and whatever primary literature presents itself immediately. And when I have a general sense of the time period I want to write about for whatever reason, then I go to visit the city and check out what sources are available. In San Francisco, I went to the Bancroft Library at Berkeley. I went to the California Historical Society Library. I went to the History Room at the Public Library, the California Pioneers. Yeah, I checked out all of these places, see what they had. And slowly, it's like feeling your way through a dark room sometimes. You find, oh, okay, that's the couch. And then you move on and you find, oh, that's the table. This is my 10th book, my fifth nonfiction book. I still feel like I'm making it up as I go along. So there's a heavy imposter syndrome, I think, that goes with the territory here.
It sounds like it's a pretty organic process. I
Yeah.
do want to ask about how you think about readers. I don't pretend to understand people listening to the show and specifically cater to them, but I do like to think about the things that they would look for. So, what do you think the average reader of historical narrative nonfiction, what are they looking for from the book?
I think they're looking to be entertained, first of all. And it's like, I'm not an academic historian. I make no bones about that. I really think that I want to bring people in on the basis of the novelistic qualities. There's a story that they want to hear the ending of. But I like to give a lot of history along with that, so that I feel like all of these books operate on two levels. So there's the city level, the history level, the sociology level, and then there's the novelistic level. I am very interested in not boring the reader. So I'm constantly thinking of, am I coming down too hard on the history here? Does something have to happen? But I can't make it happen. It has to have happened. It's a difficult process sometimes.
Yeah, you want to balance entertainment and edification and all those things in a single place and do it synthetically so it's digestible. And it seems like a threading kind of like a very narrow gap.
Yeah.
I want to ask you how you see the kind of narrative nonfiction market right now. What's your 20,000 foot perspective on this genre and how it exists right now in the marketplace? Are there any patterns or gaps you see in the market where that we need more of X, or this is something that it's just not being written enough that we need more of?
I think we're in a golden age of narrative nonfiction. I think there are a lot of writers out there who are really writing interesting books that do balance entertainment and education. I think I belong to a group of not narrative nonfiction writers. We get together every 6 weeks or so and drink and complain about the industry and stuff like that. But it's everybody is looking for something that has not been done. And it's very difficult to find something that has not been done because so many things have been done. And one thing my agent says is if it hasn't been done in the last 10 years, it's open game again. But usually you want to, if you're going to do something that hasn't been done before or that has been done before, there has to be something new that you add. If there's some new source of information that comes out since the last book, that would be a justification. But in terms of what has not been covered enough, I don't know. Certainly, we're in an age when every other book seems to be about World War II. And World War II is just so complex and fascinating that there are still stories that people write these books and you say, I never heard of that before.
Yeah, I'm
But
sure
I
that's
think,
partly the surplus of source material. There's just so
yeah.
much there, so much documentation. But then just a fascination with military history is, it always sells, I
I
imagine.
do think that technology is changing things because so many, even in my career, the course of my career, so much that I would have had to go to some remote archive to get 20 years ago, today is online. So much more has gone online over the past 20, 25 years that you can find things much, much more easily.
Yeah. Let's talk about metropolitan histories because that's what you've been up to for a while. I wanted to ask you a broad question as a start. Cities are incredibly complex entities. You've got many stakeholders, you've got many lenses you can use to write about them. But I want to start by defining it. For you, what is a city?
A city is a conurbation of a certain size. But I think what is really the defining factor of a city is that it brings together people from all different backgrounds, all different races, all different religions, all different classes, and puts them into close proximity so that their competing interests really rub up against each other. And I think that's one reason I love cities is because cities create problems that they subsequently have to solve. And so there's a lot of creative problem solving that goes on. So I think of them as like incubators of innovation. Universities operate in the same way, but they're also a source of great drama. So for the novelist in me, that appeals to me. You have all of these people with their competing interests. There's going to be a lot of conflict and confrontation, and that's always good to write about. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but
Think so. Yeah. I'm curious, what do you think separates, I don't want to use a fancy word, but ontologically between a city like Chicago in a place like Des Moines, like a mid-level city from a major metropolis? Is there something that happens to a city once it hits a certain threshold and then it changes, transforms into something else in your mind?
I do think when it hits a certain size that things start happening that are unique to the city. But here again, this is all changing. Places like Des Moines are now getting huge influx of people from all over the world. So it's no longer just the major cities that are getting these influxes of immigrants and things like that. And that's what makes these things happen, I think. I think that's all changing. I just think that cities are getting more interesting. Even the second and third tier cities are getting more interesting. And for
Yeah,
me,
I listened to a great podcast that was, I think it was a series on interesting mid-level or second-tier cities and how underrated they are. And they're spread across the US and from Knoxville to Des Moines. They're fascinating places that are sometimes overlooked within the hierarchy of cities in the US.
And then there's a place like Buffalo, New York, which 100, 150 years ago was considered a sure bet to become a really major city. And if you look at the architecture in Buffalo is incredible, but somehow Buffalo didn't quite catch fire the way it was expected. And I'm not quite sure why it didn't. That's one of the mysteries to me about urban history.
What draws your focus when you're looking at a city? You can choose to look at urban planning. You can choose to look at the history of the city council and how they ran the city. You can look at it. You can look at grassroots movements within a city. Like, how do you pick your area of focus?
There is one theme that I seem to come back to all the time. That is the establishment versus the demi-monde that exists in any city. And in the New Orleans book, it was the Storyville district, the prostitution district, the jazz culture versus the people who were saying we have to make New Orleans into a more serious city. And a very similar thing was going on in San Francisco. That's one of the themes of the San Francisco book. So I think that there are certain thematic elements that always attract me, and they usually involve groups with different interests, each trying to get their point across and make the city that they want.
Which writers doing work on the history of cities do you look to and are North Stars or aspirational? I don't know what the word I'm looking for here is, but who are the people you look to when they have a new book about a city that you're excited to purchase it?
Let's see. I can't really answer that because I can't think of anybody who's doing exactly the kind of book that I'm doing. But there are books that try to be biographies of a city.
Okay.
Peter Ackroyd has written this book, Biography of London, which I think is very interesting. I think here in the United States, Russell Shorto has written about New York and Amsterdam in ways that really interest me. So there are these people out there who are doing things remotely similar to what I do, but I'm not quite sure that anybody's doing exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah. Which city most surprised you when you were writing about it? Los Angeles, New Orleans, Chicago, and now San Francisco. Which one was the most surprising, had the most surprising elements that you didn't expect?
I would say Los Angeles, really, because I grew up a near New Yorker, and of course, New Yorkers are not supposed to like Los Angeles. And I went out there and absolutely loved the place and discovered that the reason I think New Yorkers don't like Los Angeles is because they stay west instead of going east. The farther east in Los Angeles you go, the more interesting it becomes, in my opinion. So I would say one of the things that surprised me, knowing how diverse LA is now, is how relatively not diverse it was earlier in the 20th century, in the very early 20th century. It was billing itself as this white city for Midwestern retirees, and it was only really later that it became much more diverse. So that was a real surprise for me.
That's perfect because I had a couple questions about Mirage Factory, which I enjoyed quite a bit. I've done a number of episodes recently looking at the history of LA, and we've covered these tycoons slash business executives who tried to build Los Angeles in their own image. But one person that hasn't come up that you covered was Amy Semple McPherson. I actually had a friend when I lived in Southern California who taught at a Foursquare Bible College in San Dimas. And so I was inundated with information about McPherson. Could you just briefly explain who she was and What do you think is her most lasting impact on Los Angeles?
She was this Canadian-born evangelist who basically started her own religion, the Four Square Church, and she went barnstorming around the United States and ended up doing revivals in Los Angeles and deciding this is the place that I'm going to stay. And so she put down roots, and in the 20s she built that church in Echo Park, which is still there today, and her church is still going strong. Arguably, you could say that hers was the first mega church in the United States. I'm not quite sure that's totally justified, but she really knew how to attract crowds to religion. She was very theatrical. As a matter of fact, there's this wonderful story where Charlie Chaplin said, "You are an entertainer and an actress, just the way I am an entertainer and an actor." Because she would put on these illustrated sermons with sometimes real camels and things like that. She had a sense of humor. Of course, there was the huge scandal in her life, which is she alleged that she was kidnapped. She disappeared for several months, and it caused one of these media sensations nationwide. She ultimately was found in the Mexican desert with this story about being kidnapped and kept in a hut in the desert. And basically, there are people who believe it. I am not one of them. I think she had some kind of mental break or something like that. And it really hurt her reputation for a long time. But she managed to come back in later years, particularly during the war, the World War II. And she did a lot for the local community around Echo Park. So she, I think, is a problematic character. I like to write about problematic characters, but ultimately I think she redeemed herself. And I use her, there are the three main characters in that book are William Mulholland, D.W. Griffith, and Amy Semple McPherson. I think of them as water, celluloid, and spirituality as kind of these elements that created modern Los Angeles.
It was fascinating
But
to read some of her radio broadcasts and the technique she used, and I think she was a real pioneer there as well, right?
oh, yeah, she was one of the very first radio evangelists. And she was just a likable character. Even though I thought that she was deceiving people at times, she was just so incredibly likable that it was fun to write about her.
If you could do an update, an expansion of Mirage Factory to include another character or another dimension that you think defines LA, is there anything that comes to mind that you would add?
Yeah, I think I would do Edward Doheny and the whole oil story, because I think that was another important element. So add oil to celluloid, water, and all that. And of course, he had interesting stories associated with him. But I actually considered doing a fourth strand in that book, but then I thought that's just going to get out of hand. So I do deal with Doheny and the oil story, but much more briefly than the other three. But that would be the direction I would go.
Okay, let's talk about Trespassers now, your newest book. What was the impetus for writing this? What led you to this story in particular?
The most recent entry in my City Books series was Los Angeles. And so I thought, I've done Los Angeles, I've got to do its perennial rival. The two cities could hardly be more different. They developed in entirely different ways, in entirely different time periods, really. And they're different in ethos that everybody has to be either an LA person or a San Francisco person. So I really wanted to do something about San Francisco after doing the LA book, but I knew it had to be a different time period. The LA book basically covers 1900 to 1930, but I knew that I had to go much earlier with San Francisco since that was when its big growth spurt happened, which is right around the gold rush. So I knew that that was the time period I was going to do. And so then I just started reading and looking for my foregrounded personal narrative to write about.
I think you really capture this kind of illusion about the gold rush. Lots of people showed up. I'll do narrative histories of different kind of immigrants to California, and a common theme that comes up again and again on these narrative episodes is they showed up expecting to strike it rich in the gold fields, but then this is what they did instead. And so there's this kind of illusion of wealth and riches waiting for people, and most people that showed up didn't strike it rich. They maybe develop some kind of business or something like that. But the low-hanging fruit was gone really fast. Do you think
Right.
it was mostly an illusion from the beginning?
No, because I think there was a whole industry that was mining the miners, as they said. As you say, if there's a lot of money around, that's going to siphon down to other people, the people who run the bars, the people who do legal work, which is what my main character did. And a lot of the prospectors, there was easy money at first, but easy come, easy go. The prices, first of all, in the early 50s were outrageous. People would spend $50 on a shovel, which, and $50 would be something like $1,000 today. So there was a lot of foolish spending that was responsible for a lot of people not making money. If they had actually saved what they dug out of the ground, they would have done all right, but they couldn't or didn't. But I do think that a lot of people mined the miners. That I even think that was like one of the sayings of the day. Basically just taking advantage of all this money being around. And that's how the city went from being 850 population in 48 to 25,000 less than 2 or 3 years later.
The book, you do a fair amount of stage setting to really give people a sense of place. Why was that important for you in this book to have that there?
Gold Rush, San Francisco was unlike any other place in the world. It was just a unique entity. So many of the writers of the time would remark on that. It was the most diverse urban place in the world at the time because all of these people thinking the same thing, we're going to go to San Francisco or we're going to go to California and get rich quick and all of our troubles will be over. And they came from everywhere. They came from China, they came from South America, they came from Europe, all over the United States. So there was this sense of wide openness where, the normal ceremonies that were stood upon in other places were not. Everybody was just interested in making money. So things like prejudices, people definitely brought their prejudices, but they would put them aside because it's like it's easier if I have to share, if I am a white male and I have to share a hotel room with a black male, I will do that, even though I would not do that in New York or Chicago or something like that, because that's what has to be done here because there's a housing shortage. So I think it created a unique opportunity for people, the normally marginalized people in 19th century society, Asians, blacks, women. There are a number of people I follow in the book who achieved a really abnormal amount of success in early San Francisco because of this wide open atmosphere.
Yeah, one of my favorite characters, not only in your book, but where she's been covered in other places, is Ah Toy, this incredible kind of entrepreneur, that particular landscape. Can you briefly give a synopsis of her biography?
She showed up early, I think in 50 or 52. Some sources say she was the second Chinese woman in San Francisco. She was a brothel madam and became enormously successful. And one of the remarkable aspects of her was that she used the American court system to achieve justice in her life, which was not done by Chinese males or females at this time. If somebody stole something from her, somebody mistreated her, she would take them to court and she would really win sometimes. And her life, though, really illustrates what I think is the thesis of the book was that as the city matured and more middle class families came in, and when it was connected to the rest of the country by the Transcontinental Railroad, this kind of creeping Victorianism came in, and those Victorian categories and hierarchies were more stringently enforced. And so she went from being a plaintiff in courtrooms to being a defendant in courtrooms because both city and state started passing ordinances that specifically targeted Chinese sex work. Things got much tougher for these people who didn't fit into these Victorian hierarchies.
Yeah, those in scare quotes, Victorian family values, if you will. And one more question about the world of vice. Do you think San Francisco in this early time period was exceptional in the vices that were ubiquitous in the city? Or do you think it's comparable, given your research on other big cities, is similar to other cities at this time?
In the very early years, when the population was basically 95% male, things are going to happen in that kind of atmosphere that wouldn't happen in a more balanced population. So I do think that there was a lot of fast living going on in early San Francisco that probably outstripped just about any other city of its time.
Let's jump to talking about the characters in the story. I want to actually start with not with AP, but with Laura Fair. She feels Shakespearean to me. Some
Really?
Richard III energy, just moving through the world in kind of a destructive, but just like idiosyncratic way. Do you think motivationally drove that seemingly insatiable spirit she had?
I think she wanted ultimately to be a wealthy, respectable person. And she was born, she had a tough time. Her father died when she was 16 years old, and she thought that the way to protect herself would be to marry an older, wealthy man. This is in New Orleans, where she grew up. And she ended up doing it twice. Both of them, unfortunately, turned out to be abusive alcoholics, at least as she tells it. And she divorced both of them. One of them died before the divorce fell through, but came through. But all of this happened before she was 20 years old.
Yeah,
And
how can I jump in? How common was it for someone to be married that many times? Was that
it was
unusual
not
in the time?
common because divorce was pretty hard to get in most places, and it was very frowned upon. Even a woman who was fearing for her bodily self was expected to stay with the marriage because the marriage is the important thing. So even if your husband is an abusive alcoholic, you have to stay with the marriage. And she said no, and she divorced herself twice. So she really needed a second act restart. And that's why she came to San Francisco originally in about 56 or 57. So it was after the first years of the gold rush. And unfortunately, she came when right at the start of a national recession that was especially bad in San Francisco because any mining economy goes through booms and busts. And 56, 57 was just when San Francisco was going through its first bust cycle. So she had a hard time keeping body and soul together when she first got here.
And then we have A.P. Crittenden, who is a character, it seems just to me, just not meandering through life, but just going from one opportunity to the next, just trying to make his best in the West. Do you view him as a kind of tragic character or someone that maybe chose the wrong path? How do you view him as a character?
I view him as the villain of the piece to a certain extent. He was born into this prominent Kentucky political family. His uncle, in fact, was John Jordan Crittenden, who was a longtime U.S. senator and congressman from Kentucky. He was attorney general under two different presidents. And he was actually considered a potential presidential candidate himself for a while. AP came from a somewhat less exalted part of the family. His father was a state politician, but he died also when AP was 16 years old. And he unfortunately left the family with this huge debt, $30,000 to $40,000, which was a huge amount of money in those days. And he very nobly told his mother, "I will be responsible for those debts." But those debts really haunted him for the rest of his life. And I think that's why he was like meandering and like trying this and trying that, because he always had this burden of debt over him. And that's certainly why he came to San Francisco, because he was a 49er. He came right at the beginning. As soon as he heard about it, he was living in Texas with a wife and growing family. Still just not able to make ends meet. His marriage was a little bit shaky. So when news of the gold rush came, he, like so many others, he said, "This is my chance. I will go out there, make a quick buck, and get on with my life." But unfortunately, he had a little bit of his father in him, and so he liked financial speculation. He made a number of very bad investments once he came out. So eventually, he was able to give his family a kind of comfortable upper middle class life, but always, even when he died, his estate, I looked at his estate papers and he was deeply in debt, even though his family was living a very comfortable life. So I really think that he was somebody who did not like to be told what to do. And so he had this family life that he liked. He had this mistress that he liked, and people were telling him, "You've got to get rid of the mistress. We're not going to do business with you unless you get rid of the mistress." But I think he just wanted both.
Yeah. It
And
seemed like he wanted to escape from all of that, from the debt, from all the expectations. Let's fast forward to the murder. It's as theatrical as they come, on a boat in disguise. Can you set the stage for us?
Crittenden and Fair started their affair in 63. And at first, she didn't know that he had a living wife. So he thought that she was going to get married to him. She found out that there was a Clara Crittenden who was living, and she confronted Crittenden about it. And he kept on saying, "Oh, I do not love my wife. I'm going to divorce her and marry you." And he kept on saying this for 7 years. And so he kept her on the line for 7 years, constantly saying, "We're going to go to Indiana and I'm going to get a divorce," because apparently Indiana was the Reno of its day. It was easier to get a divorce out there. And
Strange.
they would plan these trips where they're going to go to Indiana, and then he would cancel them because for one reason or another. And so finally, after 7 years, she lost it. She just lost it. Her health had been failing and things like that. And it looked like he might be reconciling with his wife. So his wife had been in the East for several months and was just coming back, and he was going on the ferry to meet her. And she followed him onto the ferry to see how the two of them would greet each other. She had some concept in her mind that if they kissed, then that means he's going to reconcile with his wife, and I've wasted these 7 years of my life. And although we don't know whether they did indeed kiss on the ferry, she came up to him and shot him in the chest in front of his wife and two of his children on a crowded ferry in public.
Wow. I keep coming back to the word Shakespearean, but yeah, the kiss and then the public assassination, if you will, wild things. Let's talk about true crime for a second. You're wading into this genre of true crime here. And there was a documentary that just came out at Sundance this year called The Zodiac Killer Project. And it was initially supposed to be a documentary about the Zodiac Killer, but they lost the rights. And so the director instead, I think his name is Charlie Shackleton, he pivoted to making a film about the true crime genre in a meta perspective, looking at its tropes. How do you avoid some of those like common like cliches of true crime?
That's a good question. I maintained a certain kind of maybe ironic distance on it, because there are certain scenes in the book that are really pretty operatic. There's one scene in which Laura Fair and Clara Crittenden finally take the gloves off, and Clara Crittenden says, "You should leave my husband alone." And Laura Fair says, "He's more my husband than yours. You're the one who's committing
Yeah, this
adultery."
is so Tosca. It's yeah, it's very much
Really,
Italian opera. So
exactly.
someone could make an
Exactly.
opera from this book, I'm sure.
Actually, maybe Adams will do it. It sounds like his kind of his John Adams. It's like I knew that there were these tropes involved in this, and I didn't want to downplay them because they were true. This is how it really happened. But I tried to put it a little bit in perspective. I still, it's like you can never really know what's going on in someone else's head, even the person sitting next to you, let alone somebody who lived 150 years ago. So it's, I try to get inside of her head and decide, did she really lose it as her lawyers claimed? She lost all consciousness. She lost all volition at the moment of shooting him. I tend to think not. In the same way, I think that Aimee Semple McPherson really wasn't kidnapped. But there are people who believe it, and there's really no way to know for sure. I try to leave some ambiguity there for the reader to decide for him or herself what they think this person was really thinking and doing.
About a month ago, I had jury duty and I managed to make it to the voir dire section. I wasn't selected, but I was in that jury box for a few minutes. And reading your book after that was such a contrast, the Gilded Age courtroom versus what we experience today when we go to jury duty. Can you unpack that for people? How different were courtrooms in the Gilded Age compared to today?
There just seemed to be an ad hoc quality to a lot of what was going on. And voir dire, they did have voir dire, and I think the rules were a lot looser, and you could basically get rid of a juror for whatever reason you wanted. And certainly in the second trial, they had to go through hundreds and hundreds of potential jurors to find a 12-person jury. And
It also
yeah, I
seems a lot
think.
more theatrical as well. It's like a pageant. They're putting on a show.
Right. Yeah. I think that there was just a kind of freer, more open quality to it. It wasn't certain. I'm not sure I would say that now that I think about it, because there were certain long arguments that went on in that trial. We have the trial transcript, so we know exactly what went on for the month-long trial. And there would be so many objections based on hearsay and this kind of thing that I, as a writer, naturally left out because it's incredibly boring. It's possible that there's not that much difference because when you're in there in the courtroom, you're seeing everything. But when I'm writing about this trial, I'm not including the 7-page argument that the defense lawyers had with the judge about whether a piece of evidence should be admissible or whether it's hearsay. I do think things were looser, but I think the basic rules of courtroom conduct, I think, were in place.
Yeah. One of the central themes of the trial is women's mental illness, or hysteria, as it was called. Can you unpack the way that the public understood hysteria, what it was, and how it impacted free will?
All of these Victorian experts and medical experts and doctors thought that so much of what they perceived as female hysteria, which was a way of silencing and marginalizing women who said things that they didn't like, were based gynecologically. In this trial, the defense brought out a parade of doctors and expert witnesses who would talk about dysmenorrhea, which is irregular menstruation, which apparently Laura Fair had. She had a long history of violent and irrational behavior when things were not going well medically. But I think it's really a reflection, I think, of sexism. I do think that women who did not play by the rules, or who were too assertive, or who actually liked sex at a time when respectable Victorian women were supposed to be sexless, all this had to be explained somehow. And they invented these connections between gynecological problems and hysteria. And it worked on at least one of the juries. But I think it's a reflection of the paternal, male-dominated society of the time.
What impact did this trial have on women's rights, or the discourse around women's rights, or thinking about women in mental illness? Were there impacts?
This was at the height of what we now call first wave feminism. And certainly the trial attracted a lot of attention. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton came out to San Francisco after the first trial results, and when Laura was in prison, and they sat with her and interviewed her. And that night they gave lectures about how she was being unfairly treated and things like that. I think it really galvanized certainly the local. I say feminist, that was not what it was called at the time, but that's what it was. The feminist suffragists and things like that. I think it really polarized sexually, or in terms of gender, a lot of the population, because a lot of the men had their ideas and a lot of women had other ideas. This was right after the Civil War, when women had proved themselves quite capable of doing traditionally male functions, because they had to do it during the war because their males were off fighting. And I think this was a time where they were saying, we're not going to go back to the days when, hearth and home was the sole thing that we worried about. We want to vote. We want to own property separate from our husbands. We want to run businesses. We want to be out in the world doing things. And I think that was one of the reasons that this trial really blew up into a nationwide sensation, because all of those issues were brought up by this case. Because Laura Fair, aside from her crime, was this kind of new, strong-minded woman that people like Horace Greeley was always railing against. Basically, women who threatened the stable society of the traditional family because they wanted to do things that were not considered feminine.
It's fascinating. After the two trials, she went on to just live 50 years in San Francisco as a book agent.
Yeah, she lost her fortune when Ralston and the Bank of California had its crisis in 76, 75. And her last decades were, she was pretty impoverished, I think. But she lived until 1919. And every anniversary of the trial, every 5 and 10 year anniversary of the trial, some newspaper or other would do a story about, oh, remember this trial? And they would get so many things wrong about what really happened. And then there would be these stories about, oh, Laura Ferrer was seen on the street the other day. She's getting older and things like that. But she managed to outlive all of her enemies, which was must have been some satisfaction to her.
Yeah. Let's close by taking kind of a 20,000 foot perspective. I've had a number of episodes where we talk about progressivism's lasting impact on California through direct democracy and the California Constitution. What would you think, or what would you say are the lasting impacts of the Gilded Age on California?
I think that the extreme income disparity that was the case nationwide, not just in California during the Gilded Age, is something that really, I think, inspired a reaction in the early 20th century that really gave us the labor movement and a lot of what we see today as the balance between rich and poor, which is we're witnessing a collapse of, I think, in recent years. So I'm not sure that there's anything specifically Californian that I would have to say about that, but I do think that we are entering a second Gilded Age here in the first quarter of the 21st century, and it's not a good thing.
Yeah. How did the writing and research for this book change your perspective on California?
I would say looking at both books together, it really underlined something that I believed about California for a long time and has really played out. And I think that it is a place where a lot of new ideas, creative problem solving originates. I think because of its extreme diversity. But also, that was one of the themes of the Mirage Factory, which is that they built this city in a place where a city really shouldn't be. It required a tremendous amount of imagination and creativity, and they delivered. That creativity was delivered. And I think that California still is the source of a lot of new ideas about even like water desalination and all of this, certainly technology. I think a lot of that is coming out of California because of this tradition of creative problem solving.
Yeah, we close these podcasts in the same place, which is with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
In terms of the primary source material, the literature on the gold rush is vast. There were so many journalists were there. They knew something special was going on, and the world was incredibly interested. So many books have been written, but everybody goes to the Bayard Taylor book, El Dorado, which is a wonderful book. He was a journalist for the New York Tribune, wrote this wonderful book about it. But I always like to put in a plug for John D. Borthwick, who wrote a book called 3 Years in California. He was a Scottish journalist, so you get a slightly different perspective. But like the Bayard Taylor book, it is just full of interesting tidbits and scenes. And it's a really wonderful book that I wish were better known. In terms of the secondary literature, there are the obvious names, Kevin Starr and Carey McWilliams. But I think two biographies that I think do a really good job of talking about the world around the figures that they're writing about. One of them is 50 years old. It's David Lavender's Nothing Seemed Impossible. It's a biography of Ralston. It's Nothing Seemed Impossible, William C. Ralston in early San Francisco. It's a wonderful book about Ralston, who's an important figure, but it also really talks in enlightening ways about early San Francisco and its development. Something more literary, Gary Scharnhurst has written a book called Bret Harte, Opening the American Literary West, which I think is a similar thing where he's talking about Hart, but he's also talking about what was going on all over California at this time. Those books, yeah.
Yeah, those are great recommendations. I love the Bret Hart book. That's a favorite of mine. To close, Gary, what are you working on next?
I always say I'm done with city books, but I'm never done with city books. It's still very early in the process, but I am looking at a couple of New York ideas. New York is the city I've lived in and around for most of my life. And people always say, why don't you write about New York? And I usually say, that wouldn't involve enough travel. One of the things I love about what I do is that I get to travel. But I think I might do something about New York next.
The book is Trespassers at the Golden Gate, a true account of love, murder, and madness in Gilded Age San Francisco. Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.